This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas, presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Melissa Idris, and you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. Joining me in the studio today is Azhar Azizan Harun, popularly known by his pen name, Art Harun. Now, in his previous life, Art was a human rights lawyer and a writer with a big online following. On September 21st, Art was appointed as the Election Commission's new chairman, and he officially assumed office on the eve of nomination day for the Port Dickson by-election. So Talk about jumping right into the deep end. Good morning to you. Welcome to the show, Art.
Morning, Melissa. Good morning, Malaysia. Thank you very much.
And if you have a specific question you'd like Art to address now, you can send those WhatsApp messages our way to 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. So, Art, I'd like to begin with public perception and the criticism that was once levied by the opposition, who are now in power, that the Election Commission lacked independence, that it served the government of the day. Yeah. Now that you're on the inside, did you find that to be true?
The previous Election Commission, I think the perception was that they were not independent, they were not impartial. I think many of the actions taken by them, particularly in the redelineation process preceding the general election, lends credit to that perception. And of course, there were certain actions taken by the retaining officers in some of the nomination centres that also lend further credit to that perception. Mm. My aim is, of course, to correct that perception, to bring the EC to being more transparent. And we do not want to be accused of being partial anymore. We want to be really, really independent and impartial.
I know it's early days still, Art. You've only been in the role for, I think, just over a month. But what have you found? Because, you know, you've been quoted as saying that, in your view, the EC has two tiers, the workforce and the policymakers. Yeah. You said that you inherited a great workforce, an excellent workforce, who are the unsung heroes of the EC. Yes. But the problem the public has is with the policymakers. Mm. So talk to me about that. Who are the policymakers?
Well, first of all, I have to reiterate that the workforce is excellent. I've said that because, you know, the EC has been organizing elections since 1959 and successfully doing it, you know, without any major event, except, of course, 1969. But that wasn't caused by the EC. So the workforce is excellent. And after about 1 month being there, that further cement my opinion as such. I have really good support. And in Port Dickson, it shows, you know. Okay, then we come to the policy. The policy is where the chairman, the deputy chairman, and the commissioners are. Mm-hmm. They are the committee, they are the policy people.
They are the policy
people. They are the policy people. So if we talk about a company, this is the board of directors. Yeah. And the management, the CEO, they are the operational guys. So if the policies are not good, or if the policies are not independent, not impartial, then this will flow down to the workforce.
Right.
Because they just carry out the policies.
So last week it was announced that 5 EC commissioners, including your deputy, will end their tenure prematurely on 1st of January next year. Yes. We have one more EC commissioner, Dato' Balasingham Karupia, who's left.
Yes.
So who will you be looking to replace them?
Well, I have approached a person whom I cannot name, who is a very good activist, a very good academic, and I'm going to push for his name to be one of the commissioners, probably even my deputy.
Are you looking for outside the civil service?
Outside the civil service. I'm looking at a mixture. I'm looking from the outside, the academics, the activists who actually work on the ground, you know, and the academic can come in with the knowledge, with the theory, yeah. And of course, I'm also looking at also from within the civil servant, because we need the continuity, we need the connection. We cannot run away from civil service, you know. We need the police, we need the army, We need the National Registration Department. Mm. So we need all this connection as well. So there must be a mixture.
But then, you know, all the commissioners were from the civil service. In fact, you were the only one in the EC who's outside the civil service, the first person, in fact, to chair the EC outside the civil service.
Yeah.
Do you think this is a role that seems to be a reward to civil servants post-retirement?
That's a perception, isn't it? I mean, all of them are retirees. You know, then they are appointed as commissioners or as chairman or as deputy chairman. So that's a perception, but I can't really say so.
I hope you're looking at women as well, because I'm looking at your board of directors here, the EC commissioners, they're all men.
Yeah. In fact, today I'm meeting a woman candidate just after this interview.
That's good to know. I'd like to also talk about some of the issues in the electoral system that need to be addressed. The inconsistencies in the electoral roll are well documented. Mm. Voters with the same name, the same date of birth, same address, voters that appear to be both ordinary voters and postal voters.
Yeah.
Have you begun to look at cleaning up the electoral roll?
Okay, the electoral roll, you know, under the law, we have to review the electoral roll every quarter. So it's an ongoing process.
Mm-hmm.
And that is within my power to do so. I don't need any kind of outside help or assistance. I don't need any change of the law, any amendment to the regulation to do that. So that was the first initiative that I did in my first full day in office, you know. So I have formed a policy committee, which I head myself, and below that is a working committee. We have met, we have brainstormed, and we are going to, I think, in fact, the exercise has begun last week.
So cleaning up the electoral roll does not require any changes to the law. Is it as simple as crossing out the names on the electoral roll? How do you cross-reference?
All right. Of course, the exercise are twofold. One is to add new voters. The other one is to clean up the roll by removing those who are dead, you know, those who have moved away or whatever. So it's twofold. Of course, it sounds simple as adding and subtracting, right? But the process is the process of verification.
Mm.
That is the important thing. Prior to this, I think we relied too much on the National Registration Department. If somebody has died, and the National Registration Department did not provide us with information, no death certificate, for example, then their name remains on the electoral roll. I have visited the law, and the law said the chief registrar must satisfy himself. So the National Registration Department is just only one way of satisfying himself. There are other ways of satisfying himself.
Like what?
Like going to the ground.
Checking up. So
yeah.
Due diligence.
Yes. I mean, if the National Registration Department say 146-year-old is still alive, but there is a picture of a grave, so are you satisfied that he's alive? You know, so we have to go a step further. And that's what I want to do. We cannot just say, okay, this guy is 130 years old, there is no death certificate, and that's it. We have to go a step further. And that's what I want to inculcate in the EC.
How much cleaning up does the electoral roll need?
I think quite a lot. I have had data last week, person who are above 90 years old. There are about, if I'm not mistaken, about 70 to 90,000 people, you know.
70 to 90,000 of voters are above 90 years old?
I think so, yeah. If I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong. But those are the numbers that we're looking at, you know. And then, of course, when we talk about electoral roll, there are also other problems where a house, an address, has 20 or 40 voters registered there, you know. And then, of course, there are some instances where they have the same IC numbers, but those cases are not many.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also have a sudden movement of voters into one constituency, you know, a sudden upsurge in numbers of voters in one constituency. I think that arose from the voter registration exercise before, where NGOs and political parties were allowed to set up stalls, you know, and voters will come with the IC, and then they just give the IC. They don't even know what
they're registering for.
Yeah, what they're registering for, and where they're registering, you know, and then So we are looking at all all angles.
I'm speaking to Art Harun, the newly appointed Election Commission Chairman, and we're going to continue our conversation in just a few minutes and discuss redelineation and the one man, one vote principle. Stay tuned to The Breakfast Grill, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Thanks for staying with us on The Breakfast Grill. I have here with me the man appointed to chair the Election Commission, Azhar Azizan Harun, or better known as Art Harun. Now, thank you everyone for your WhatsApp questions and comments so far. I just want to say thank you to Nick Azan and Ku SK, as well as Adam for your questions. It's not too late to send them in. The number to do so is 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. So a WhatsApp question from CL on redelineation. And I thought we could focus on that for the next few minutes, Art, in terms of redelineation and the one man, one vote principle. Now, according to the Constitution, redelineation can be carried out once in every 8 years. So are we going to be stuck with the current delineation for the next 8 years?
Sadly, yes, we are. Under the Constitution, the EC can only exercise the, can only revisit a redelineation exercise once in 8 years. The only exception to that is when Parliament or the respective state legislative assembly decide to increase or decrease the number of seats. When that happens, then that would trigger the exercise of redelineation, notwithstanding the eight-year period. So, however, for that to happen, the Constitution needs to be amended. So that needs a two-third majority. So at least on the face of it now, we are stuck with the redelineation that was passed by the Parliament prior to the general election this year. However, what I intend to do is actually to analyse the redelineation, to form an opinion whether it's fair or not, to also form an opinion whether it is constitutional, whether it is in compliance with the 13th schedule of the Federal Constitution.
Which is?
There are many provisions in the 13th schedule. One of the most glaring provisions in the 13th schedule is that the ratio of voters between one constituency and another shall be approximately the same.
So this is the one man, one vote principle.
Yes, except for when there are circumstances like logistical problems or rural area, then you need to have a weighted ratio. You know, so. If we look at the redelineation process, the redelineation that has been approved by the Parliament prior to the GE, it is very clear that that principle is not followed. It's not followed. Because, you know, we have a constitution with 25,000 voters which has one member of Parliament, and we have a Tony Pua, for example, constitution with 170,000 voters with one member of Parliament. So that is quite clear. So what I intend to do is to actually look at the redelineation, come up with an opinion, whether it's fair or not, whether it is equal or not, whether it is in compliance with the Federal Constitution or not, then I will just proceed to probably come up with a blueprint of what a fair redelineation would look like, you know, without actually triggering the exercise in the Constitution. Because if I trigger that, it will be unconstitutional. I have no power. Yes? So I will do that anyway. And I will just push it to the government.
So what you're saying is that GE15, this is the delineation we are stuck with. Fair or not fair, we're stuck with this.
At least at this time, looking at the Federal Constitution, unfortunately it is.
The EC has also had to distinguish between urban, semi-urban and rural areas. And you mentioned, you know, the one man, one vote principle in Malaysia with rural weightings.
Yes.
You have that rural preferential weightings, right?
Yes.
How are you going to demarcate what is rural, what is semi-urban and what is urban?
Well, we have to look at the socio-economic reality of the country right now. And we have to come up with a proper definition of what is rural and what is urban. Whether we are just going to look at the at that problem or at that issue from purely economic point of view.
Or logistical, geographical.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we need to come up with a proper definition, really. And when
what is the current definition now?
It's unclear. You know, they just simply carve out areas from one constitution and put it in another, from one constituency and put it in another, and that kind of thing. So this, you know, I'm a lawyer. I dislike non-clarity, you know, because to me, for order to be preserved, there must be clarity. Yeah. When clarity is not there, then it is open to interpretation. And when interpretation is needed, then there are various kind of interpretation. And interpretation could be warped due to interest, you know. So we need clarity.
Art, is the one man, one vote principle at all possible here in Malaysia?
It is possible if we come up with a proper and very fair and equal demarcation and redelineation.
So you see it happening?
I see it happening. Or rather, we have to try our best to achieve that. Yeah, of course, I don't think there is a perfect system. Yeah, but we could work in a way to achieve as much as possible.
I also want to talk about early voting or postal voting. The former chief of Bersih 2.0, Marie Chenabla, who was also the MP for PJ, she said that postal voting had been a major failure in the May 9th elections.
Yeah.
Do you agree?
I somewhat agree. I think the failure lies in the fact that the campaign period was only 11 days. And within that 11 days, they posted the postal ballot paper, and I think they gave a 2-day margin for the ballot paper to arrive. And of course, that's not realistic. You know, you're going to post to I don't know where, to Brighton in 2 days. It could be a Saturday or Sunday, and then it may take one or other 2 days for people to actually mark their ballot paper and repost it back.
Mm. Yeah. So you're talking about overseas voters,
overseas, right? Yeah. So you have to have a margin. You cannot say 2 days and that's it. You know, 2 days go and 2 days back and 1 day to vote. So on paper it's just 5 days, right? No, it doesn't work that way.
Mm. So how are you going to be looking to change this system before the next general elections?
We would like to have, or at least I would like to have a longer campaign period.
And what's the ideal in your mind?
I would say 14 to 21 days would be ideal.
So 11 is too short, so 14 to 21 days.
Yeah. Indonesia, their election is next year. Their campaign has started now. It's 7 months. But of course, you know, we do not want a 7-month campaign period, yeah? But it has to be realistic, to be fair. Because if it is too short, then that campaign will only be could be effectively done by the major political parties because they have all the machinery.
They have the resources,
yeah.
Yes.
So we have to think about other smaller political parties. We have to think also for the independent. Yeah. So I think 14 at least and 21 days would be good.
And who do you think should be allowed for early voting or postal voting? At the moment, we have the military personnel, yes. Police personnel, EC officers and media personnel, right, who have election-related duties for the day.
Yes.
Do you think, now this is a question from Adam, will the EC ever consider allowing those who are registered to vote in Sabah and Sarawak or even, you know, other areas of Peninsula Malaysia who are in a different region on polling day to be included as early voters?
Yeah, I mean, those are not early voters. Those are absentees.
Absentee voters.
So we are looking into that. We want to come up with an SOP, with an avenue for people like in Sabah and Sarawak who work in Singapore, for example, who work in Johor Bahru, you know, to vote without having to go back. But there is another issue to that, you know. The issue is this. I term this as a domicile-based voting system.
What do you mean by that?
Because, you know, we have got this, it is our culture, yeah, to be tied up to our kampung. So I'm a resident of Kuala Lumpur, for example, but I want to go back to Kedah to vote, which I did. So that's domicile-based because I haven't changed my domicile, although I have changed my residence. Yeah. So, but if we change our system to a residential-based voting system, then this problem would not arise because you vote where you reside. Yeah. But of course, this needs further studies because if we implement this, then it will change the whole voter demography. So this needs change in policy, and the policymakers will have to decide on this.
We have a question from both Azhar and Vincent asking, can election dates be fixed in advance?
That's part of the agenda that we're looking into as well. Whether we want to be, whether we want to have a fixed election date,
yep,
like in the UK, but also giving the parliament the power to approve an earlier election day. Yeah, that's part of the law that we're looking
at. So you've mentioned a lot of things that you want to do, right?
Yeah.
So many reforms and studies that you want to undertake.
Yeah.
Do you expect pushback from this?
For sure.
Who's it going to come from?
I'm not too sure from who, but you know, when you talk about changes are not comfortable. Yeah. Like the one that I told you about the domicile-based voting system, or versus the residential-based voting system. That's not going to be comfortable, because once you do that, or rather if you did that, then the whole demography would change. You know, then voters from outstation cannot go back to their kampung to influence the kampung folk to vote in a certain manner anymore. So, yeah, there'll be pushback. But, you know, I intend to do my job, and I think my staff intend to do their job. And where the job entails a change of policy, then we will let the policymakers to decide.
How far are we from automatic voter registration?
Yeah, that is part of it as well. we are looking at... The ideal to me is to have an identity card, IC, which is also a voting card. That would be ideal. To have an IC card means that you're a citizen. And when you attain the age of majority to vote, whether 18 now, or 21 now or 18 later, then with that IC, that is also a voting card, you know. So that's the ideal to me. But of course, that will entail looking at the SOP and the procedure of the National Registration Department, looking at the validity of the IC cards and that kind of thing. So once that is done, then that would, of course, simplify the procedure for automatic registration. But, of course, when the automatic registration is implemented, the domicile-based voting system would immediately or automatically be changed to residential voting system.
So you kill two birds with one stone.
Kill two birds with one stone, but is there a political will to do that?
I'd like to come back and address that. We're going to continue our conversation with Art Harun, the newly appointed EC chairman, after the 8:30 news bulletin. Make sure you stay with this special extended breakfast grill. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Thanks for staying with the Breakfast Grill. I'm Melissa Idris, and here with me is Azhar Azizan Harun, popularly known as, by his pen name, Art Harun. He was appointed the Election Commission's new chairman last month. He's the first person to chair the EC from outside the civil service. Now, Art, just before the news, we were talking about political will, talking about automatic voter registration, whether there's political will for this. I'd like you to answer your own question, if you could. Is there political will for this, like there was political will for the lowering of the voting age to 18?
Well, I have not really sat down to discuss this kind of policy with the current government. So I've only sat down with the Election Reform Committee, headed by Tan Sri Rashid. We are eye to eye on this. So I'm quite glad. And I think we can complement each other. I welcome the formation of that, establishment of that committee. And I think if the government had taken step to form the committee to look into reform, then I presume there is political will to reform.
I also would like to touch on the Election Offences Act.
Yes.
I'd like to get better clarity as to what is and what is not permissible under this act. What is an election offence?
Well, these are all stated in the Election Offences Act. We actually have an act specifically for election offences. Basically, what it says is you cannot indulge in corrupt practices, and you cannot indulge in illegal practices. And the corrupt practices is, of course, you know, using money to fish for votes, using gift, that kind of thing.
What about makan, minum?
Makan, treating. Minum. That is called treating. Treating. So, of course, the law is there. And it is a very old piece of law, I think taken from the UK. And in the UK, these various provisions have been visited by the court many, many times and have been interpreted many, many times, you know. And these are precedents in the UK. In the UK. However, in Malaysia, sadly, there are not much legal precedent, court decisions, yeah, in this respect. So it is still open to interpretation. And whether our court is willing to follow the precedent set by the UK court is another thing. And that is number one. And number two, our courts here, unfortunately, when they preside over election petition, they have imposed a really, really high threshold or burden of proof for all these kind of offences or allegations, you know. You not only have to prove the allegation of corrupt practices or illegal practices or treating, you also have to prove that those offences have affected the result, you know. So you actually have to, I mean, if there is a candidate who go there and give gift to voters, you actually have to prove, okay, how many voters have taken it and how their voting pattern had been changed by that gift. You know?
Right.
So that is a very high threshold.
So if I understand correctly, the EC does not have any investigative powers, right? It doesn't have prosecutorial powers as well. So is it the MACC that has to investigate this?
And the police. So if it is bribery, it will be MAC. If illegal practices or any other offences, it will be the police. Although the EC organises and oversees elections, we do not have investigative powers, nor do we have any prosecutorial powers. Yeah, we can make noise, and I have made some noise. So we can do that. So by setting guidelines or making reminders or imploring candidates to follow the law, we can do that. Mm. And I intend to do that, yes.
So there's a WhatsApp question from Hajar who's asking, how would you define an impartial EC?
I think an impartial EC must be independent from the influence and interference of political parties. We must act in accordance with the law. We must be fair. And fairness is entrenched in the law. If you look at the 13th schedule of the Constitution, fairness is entrenched there. So it is not an alien concept, you know. So we just have to follow the provision of the law. And I think that would bring the perception of fairness. It's as simple as that.
And a follow-up question from her as well is, how do you define a successful role as EC chair?
Now, that's quite subjective, isn't it?
How do you define it? How would you define a successful job?
To me, a successful job, to me, is when I manage to steer the EC to put things in accordance with the law. And that's, I think, is an objective test. Because the law is there, I follow the law, and that's about it.
Art, what do you think is the public's perception of you? Do you think that you are seen as politically linked?
I think to a certain extent, there are thought that I remember when I was appointed, Tun was interviewed in the parliament, and I think spontaneously he said he doesn't know me. And then the next day, I think I saw a picture of myself beside Tun during a dinner. So the perception the perception that it brought was that Tun knows me and therefore I'm not independent. I have to make that clear. I have met Tun 4 times in my life.
4 times?
4 times. 2 in Marina Mahathir's open house, Raya open house, twice. We took picture and that's about it. I don't even think that he remembers my name. The 3rd time was when I moderated the Nothing to Hide forum.
Oh, the one with the shoe.
Yeah, where we ended up with slippers and flares being thrown at us. Okay. The 4th one was at that dinner. That dinner was organized for activists, for writers and that kind of thing. And when I went there, the organizer said, "You are sitting beside Tun." So I was quite surprised. Why am I sitting beside Tun? So I've sat beside Tun. Again, that was the 4th time I met him. I have to introduce myself. My name is Azhar. I don't know whether he registers in his mind.
So are you looking to shake off this perception that you're politically linked? How are you trying to ensure that you are seen to be impartial?
There is nothing to be shaken off from, you know. Because, okay, nobody knows this. My involvement in election laws started with the Barisan Nasional in 2004. I acted for candidates of Barisan Nasional. I held his hand. I advised his nomination process. Two of them. And in 2004, I appeared for UMNO and Barisan Nasional candidates in election petitions. Most of the legal precedents that is being used now are from those cases where I acted for Barisan Nasional candidates. So why are people not talking about that? And in my whole involvement in election petition, I've only acted once for Pakatan opposition, the then opposition, i.e. for Datuk Zahid Ibrahim. Once. Compare that to all my involvement for Barisan Nasional candidates. Why do people not talk about that? Well, of course, they don't know. Today, they know.
Today, well.
Yeah. And I have advised candidates for electoral processes from both sides of the fence. And the fact that I advise for both sides of the fence show that I'm impartial, I'm independent, I just follow the law. And if people know that I've been advising Barisan Nasional, why then the Pakatan people also ask for my advice if I'm not independent?
So in looking for the new election commissioners, how are you going to ensure that you've got the right people? Because one way or another, there's always going to be the perception
for sure
that they are politically linked.
For sure. I mean, I will try, of course, to find people who are actually qualified for the job. I think that's the first thing, you know. They must be qualified. They must know the law. They must know the process. They must have the passion. And then they must have this commitment for being fair and rule and legal and law-abiding people, you know. I think that is the first one. Once you have that, then the perception of being partial or independent will just go away.
I'd like to end our conversation with a question on WhatsApp from Saminathan, who says he misses Art's Facebook postings. I think that he says that he thinks you should not quit social media.
I don't feel comfortable right now to just post everything because, you know, I have this itchy hand. I tend to put what I think into writing. So, you know, right now, I don't even read news because once I read the news, I will form an opinion and I want to write about it. So I read very little news nowadays because I don't feel comfortable writing out my thoughts.
So why do you feel like you have to hold back?
Because, you know, I might just say things like I used to before, you know, and it might just rile up some people. It might just give a perception that, you know, I'm anti this or pro that. So to me, let's just stop for the time being.
And on that note, I want to say thank you so much for speaking with us today.
It's been a pleasure.
It's been such a pleasure, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you very much.
That was Art Harun, the newly appointed EC chairman. Thank you so much for all your messages this morning. I hope I got your questions answered. I'm Melissa Idris for The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, Frost & Sullivan Malaysia's mobile data service provider of the year.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.